empathy is the ultimate performance enhancer. I love this idea I saw in a 2018 presentation from MozCon, the Seattle-based digital marketing conference. When I think about this phrase and who embodies it, a lot of names come to mind. For content marketing, it's Brittany Berger. For entrepreneurship, it's Tiffany Da Silva. For design, it's Meg Lewis. And when it comes to SEO, I immediately associate empathy-driven top performance with today's guest, Brittany Muller. In a world where we search for answers online to our most mundane and to our most important questions alike, SEO plays an important role in shaping our perception, ideas, and even our habits. So we know that empathy is fundamental for keeping SEO a positive force in the industry, one that helps companies and users alike. But why does this matter, and how does it translate into practice? Stick around to find out. Welcome to the Drag and Drop Show, where we explore how practicing empathy transforms how we do business and live our lives. I'm your host, Andra Zaharia, a fellow podcast listener and creator. This season, I'm on a journey with Bannersnack to discover how leading women around the world use empathy to connect and do work that matters. Join us to find out how to drag and drop small acts of empathy into our lives to make it more rewarding for us and those around us. Brittany's work doesn't fit any regular patterns, and that's why I learned so much from her. As a senior SEO scientist at Moz, Brittany's work ranges from product R&D to creating educational SEO content to reverse engineering websites. Her experiments, work, and insights make Brittany a key source of industry knowledge. And it's not just SEOs that follow her. The wider digital marketing community does it too. That's because Brittany is a pro at helping others with thought-provoking ideas they can use to develop their own thing. And now we get to hear her in action. Brittany blends technical SEO with big data, machine learning, data science, content creation, public speaking, and much more, topping it all off with loads of empathy. The result is an educational experience that opens a world of possibility for creatives of all colors, from marketers to entrepreneurs and developers. So today we get the chance to see the world from her perspective and better understand how empathy makes us more creative thinkers and doers with a purpose. So Brittany, tell me, when did empathy make the biggest impact on your life?
Yeah, well, first, that was such a beautiful intro. Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing this.
That was lovely. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah, so empathy has sort of always been baked into what I do. And I think a large part of that comes from the way I was really brought up. I mean, it was something my parents taught both my brother and I very early on. And I'm originally from Minnesota, which is kind of in the middle of the United States, way up north by Canada. And we're a bit known for empathy and just being kind to people. That has always been a big, big kind of priority for my family, you know? So being raised around that and seeing that in my parents every single day with the people that they worked with and their friends and, you know, all of that, I think had a really big imprint. And also, I think I noticed early on how having genuine empathy created opportunities for me. Very early on, where I noticed just being genuine and really looking at it from the other person's point of view created a world of opportunities that I wouldn't have had I just walked into different situations trying to sell myself or looking for the opportunity for me, or, you know, having like the kind of selfish focus point. So yeah, I think it's just naturally come over time like that.
That's so wonderful to hear, because I feel like empathy is so is something that we understand instinctively, all of us, but it's so difficult for us to define or to be able to point, I don't know, in our environment or in relationships with other people, because it's sometimes confused with sympathy. And there's, I mean, the emotional spectrum is pretty large. And I wanted to ask, what do you think makes Minnesota a place that has this distinctive characteristic? That's something I've seen it in TV shows and I've seen it all around. I mean, it's top of mind for me and I'm on the other side of the world. So I find that wonderful.
That is so funny. It's such a good question. I honestly have no idea. And it's funny, like as I get older, I notice it more and more when I go back. I think I really took it for granted growing up, and it was just like that was the way things were and it was totally normal. And I felt like when I graduated college from the University of Minnesota, I had this dream of working in New York and doing stuff out in New York. And when I went out there for different job interviews, it was like a major slap in the face to realize that, oh, everyone isn't that nice. Like, not everyone will help you with directions. Like those sort of things were really hard for me. But yeah, I don't know where that comes from. That's such a great question. I think Minnesota is this wonderful melting pot too. There's lots of like Norwegian heritage and lots of great Native American heritage. And I'm lucky enough to be a byproduct of those two things. So I don't know. There's got to be something in the lineage of that just like cultivated it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it might be the diversity as well, because I know that this is a key topic in your work in general and throughout all the presentations that you do in the community and so on. And of course, it's such a vivid trait that we associate with Moz as well. So I really love how your upbringing and your personal history really intertwines with the work, because I feel like in everyone that's a community leader, in everyone who we value and follow and look up to, there's always this mix where the job itself gives you an actual opportunity to cultivate your traits even further and make an even bigger impact with them. So I really, really love seeing that in your work. And plus, you've taken your studies, which are public relations, and now you're basically working in data science, which is such an interesting transition. And I would love to find out how you managed to cultivate your this ability to combine empathy and technology, and of course your knack as a communicator with this very data-driven aspect of your job.
Yeah, that is such a good question. Oh my gosh. I love being asked new and interesting questions like this that have never been asked before.
Thank you.
Yeah, such a brilliant question. Oh my gosh. So my immediate gut reaction when you asked that is that empathy really comes from a genuine place. Like I feel like the empathy that is, you know, most pure and most effective is really genuine. And I think when I got into the world of technology and websites and digital marketing, I realized that I could do that most effectively when my suggestions and my work and my strategies were rooted in truth. And oftentimes, the only way I was able to get to that truth was through things like data science. And so very early on, I became well aware of the power of machine learning and the power of data science and how some of my work was ineffective because I wasn't using that as kind of a superpower to make my work more efficient and more accurate, quite frankly. There's this big saying in machine learning, you know, that all models are wrong, but some models are useful, and it couldn't be more true, you know? And so it's kind of given everything that we have, we're never going to hit on the exact truth of the matter. But if we can get as close to possible for clients and be able to root strategy, root keywords, root content marketing in the things that we feel confident that will move the needle for a particular client, I can speak much more confidently with that client and about this work and this effort than not putting in that extra kind of scientific work to back it up.
That's a wonderful perspective, especially because I feel this is such a pressing need right now in terms of maintaining authenticity and speaking to the right customers, especially through a delicate period where marketing in general of all types and in all shapes and forms is being challenged as being too salesy or as being insensitive sometimes towards what people are going through. And there's this entire emotional complexity that's basically overwhelmed everyone, including us marketers, because, well, we're people too. And throughout all of this, this combination of between technology and I guess human insight or intuition is incredibly important, but there's no recipe for it. This is not a prescriptive approach. You have to figure it out on your own. And that's where all these personal traits and qualities and tendencies, I feel, come in. And that I can see making the difference between companies that really lead in that space. And I've seen a meat-selling company that published on Twitter this entire thread about critical thinking, which basically was absolutely incredible. And I see all these brands that are doing such an incredible job in really stepping outside their role in the community and doing something fantastic. And that's clearly driven by a deep understanding of their customers, because at the end of the day, that's where we all have to start from. I wanted to ask in this context, given that you have access to a sophisticated or an articulate, a clearer version of the truth, how do people resonate with that concept? Because I feel there's still some resistance in the marketing world or outside of it, generally in companies, around data science and around reliability around data, especially because machine learning and artificial intelligence are still very experimental, very incremental, and people want surefire solutions as fast as possible.
Oh my gosh, you're exactly right. That is kind of the fine line. And I've experienced both polar sides of that, where even within the last couple of months, I got really excited about this one particular machine learning model for a client. And it didn't work the way we expected. It wasn't totally accurate. While it worked for a bunch of other websites I tested on, it didn't really work for theirs. But I'm very transparent in the fact that these are experimental and that machine learning, I mean, it's not the smartest thing in the world, right? It's only as smart as the data and the bias you put into it. And so you have to expect at some point, for example, like if a website only has 3 years of traffic data and you're trying to predict traffic but previously it's kind of all over the place, it's going to be really difficult. So you have to take all these weird little things into consideration, but that kind of, I'm sort of more on the side of let's just try it and see how it does, because I'm so excited and I think it's so much fun. And we're all learning from it. And so usually it's very little investment from the website or the client, and it's more experimental on my end. On the other side of things, where it goes from, you know, I'm not so sure, this might not really work, and here's how little I know about what the model's actually doing, you know, and I try to in so many ways describe what the internal model is doing and applying weights to different factors, to the other side of things where it's not really a machine learning, you know, black box. It's really driven in data that I can show. And I think that's what's the most powerful for marketers and for SEOs today is, you know, let's say you have a client that wants to rank number one for a particular term and they're dead set on it. You do a search for that and you can see very, very clearly what it is that Google is showing. Because you have to remember, Google houses the world's information. They know what the majority of people searching for a particular thing are most likely to want, most likely to go after, whether that be images or video or product or whatnot. They know what that endpoint satisfies the user. And so as marketers, we need to lean heavily into that and evaluate, okay, well, what are they showing? What does this intent look like of the searcher? And oftentimes it doesn't match the particular client or the particular product. And it's really a educational moment of showing and explaining that and saying, you know, sit down with me, let's look at this. Consider why you might not be competitive here and why this is okay, because you have other incredible opportunities over here. And so you can kind of redirect the conversation back to things that you feel more confident in their success and being able to rank and, you know, again, solve for that searcher intent. Where does that live? So I sort of play between those very different ends. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
But it's this experimental approach that I feel is so incredibly powerful as a learning experience, especially when it's shared across teams. And I love how you talked about visualization and all this nuance that I feel only, well, it evolved obviously like in any other field, but in SEO now it's really visible. I mean, the nuance layer and the context, the intent, they've become so important, but people are still having a difficult time understanding how to do it and how to do it at scale, because that's a big challenge. I mean, as humans, we infer context right away. And yes, we make mistakes, but we're basically trained to do that while machine learning algorithms are still picking that up. And we're still, I mean, we're teaching them a great deal. So when you have all this nuance, how does it feel to apply that skill for brands who are really big and who have like high volumes and find this balance between authenticity and being able to meet the customer where they need and when they need it?
Yeah, that's another brilliant, brilliant question. And I think the magic in finding that sweet spot really lies in completely understanding their goals. And I mean, down to not only what are the KPIs they care about, but what are their perceived goals of the future? Are they after the short term or are they after the long term? That's often a conversation I have. And sometimes it'll be a hybrid approach, but sometimes, you know, clients are, you know, somewhat desperate to get results quickly. And so if you can know that, the sooner you know that, the better you can perform and satisfy the client. But without knowing, you know, where their head is at and what it is that they're trying to achieve, it's really difficult to kind of meet the needs where they're at. And so whether that be, you know, I also always love to ask, what are your highest profit margins in order of either like a product or a service? That's one of my first questions is, you know, should we be prioritizing on these different things over the rest of the products or the rest of the services? And oftentimes that's helpful to create focus for the marketer and for the SEO, because you're exactly right. Oftentimes with these large brands and these huge websites, it would be impossible to market for everything. It would be impossible to go in and optimize every single page on the website. It's just way too large. And so then it really turns into a scalability issue of, okay, well, as you know, a person in my position, what are the things I have control over that can create immediate opportunities for the client? And so then your brain should really shift into deeply understanding their website. And a great example of this is, you know, with these really large, unwieldy websites, you can do different analysis through Google Analytics and Screaming Frog, and you can identify very thin, low or zero traffic pages that you can de-index and kind of clean out from their basically website graph of pages. And what that does is it elevates the website's perceived quality in the eyes of Google. Because you also have to, if you're an SEO, you're always coming at these problems as like Google bot. Like your brain is thinking like a crawler. Mm-hmm. And so you're thinking, okay, so the way crawlers crawl the internet and crawl websites, how could the crawler perceive your site as higher quality than it currently is? One is just getting rid of cruft, getting rid of low traffic, low thin quality pages, and elevate the perceived quality of your website. Two is like having better intent matches for the keywords you're after, right? Just like overall, like thinking of the website in terms of like something you can mold and shape to basically support.
It's kind of like looking for, I need, or articulating an identity. And as you go through this process, you constantly evolve and you grow and you add things and then you realize you don't need them anymore. And it's still, it's a living organism. And I, for one, love seeing it like that because, well, as a content marketer, I'm plugged into everywhere and I'm trying to just work as much SEO insight into my work as possible, simply because it helps me gauge exactly that interest and speak to the people who want to hear from me, which is something that's been on repeat in the marketing world for such a long time. But now I feel there's no more ramp up time. I mean, we have to do it now because people and each one of us are in a situation where we have limited attention, limited mental space, and that's been overcrowded with so many emotions and feelings and reactions. And there is no choice. I mean, we can't hide behind excuses or appearances or whatever it may be. We really have to be there for other people. And there's also power in this, because I loved your tweet the other day where you said that anxiety is incredibly contagious, but so is calm, and that as marketers, we're kind of in a flight attendant role, and when other people look at us, it's up to us to convey that sense of calm. So very, very curious, how does this look from an SEO's perspective? How do you bring this from a conceptual level to a tactical one?
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's difficult. You know, I think oftentimes there's no blueprint for doing SEO the right way for any given website, because it's kind of like prescriptive, like exactly like what you said. And it's like a person, you know, like websites are like people and you need different prescriptions and therapy for different people, you know? And so I think it really comes down to giving the individual the tools to identify those things and to kind of on their own create their own heuristic model of sorts, where they can approach any given website and with the tools that they have can create a pretty good plan of action based on the things that they know move the needle. Common website things within your control. Just having a really good tool set for competitive analysis will take you so far. So if you can identify websites' actual search competitors, oftentimes these are different than what the client thinks that their competitors are, right? And if you can kind of reverse engineer, okay, well, why are they this client's competitors and what are they doing really, really well? What are the, you know, what are the keywords that maybe them and another website rank really well for that your client isn't even on their radar? And then you start to come up with different ideas. And not only that, but it helps you kind of dial in some keyword research to find real keyword opportunity gaps where you see a particular keyword with decent volume, hopefully. And it doesn't have to be crazy amounts. I've even done this with like 50 to 100 searches a month, but it has very low competition. And not only that, when you do the actual search, and this is something I think not enough people do, when you're doing keyword research and when you're doing analysis for client, you should be doing the actual searches in an incognito browser. And when you're doing that, think of the user. And so a funny example I've used a lot, that's just, it's a favorite of mine, is I was doing SEO for an MRI company, a medical scanning company. And when we were doing keyword research, my team and I thought it was so funny. We kept kind of coming across this open versus closed MRI. And our particular client is the largest open MRI company in the US, or was at the time. And we thought, you know, this is interesting. People are curious about it. They're trying to do comparisons. Let's see what that search result page looks like. And when we went to the result page, no one was providing comparison. No one had answers about the differences, what it even like, what it looked like versus a close, all this stuff. And we kept kind of saying to this client, even though we weren't on for content, we were just on to help optimize the site a bit. We kept pushing. We said, you know, what if we just made this page for fun, as a squeeze page of sorts, and see, you know, just see how it does. And they didn't like this idea. They thought it was weird. The two CEOs at the time were totally against this idea. And so it took a couple pushes, and, you know, finally we were able to get them just to be like, okay, go for it. And 4, 5, 6 years later, I would continue to get random phone calls from the CEOs laughing because that page continued to bring double the traffic of their homepage and an incredibly qualified amount of traffic. And it was just like, it was something, honestly. And what was so beautiful about that was like, that wasn't me. That wasn't my team even, right? This wasn't us. This was literally the data showing itself through our process. And I think that's what's so beautiful is, you know, you don't know that these things are necessarily going to work. You don't know that these are going to be home runs, but you have to go with your gut every once in a while and take some of those risks. And like you kind of alluded to earlier, like it's prescriptive and you can always pivot, you know, and that's the beauty of it. And oftentimes that is the best recipe for success is, you know, you suggest these things, you repurpose top performing content for a particular website. Maybe it's on YouTube, maybe it's on SlideShare and Quora and all of these other places. Then after a few months, you revisit that and you say, did we get qualified traffic from any of those platforms? And if maybe you didn't for a couple, don't invest in them anymore. You know, so it's a constant kind of rinse and repeat of best practices. And I think that gets people closer and closer to the goals.
It absolutely does. And I love that story. I think it's such an sometimes, especially for smaller companies who have more limited resources, it's such an it is an act of empathy to create these kind of resources for people, whether it's a comparison or a free guide or something that really takes something apart and walks people through it in a way that's actually practical and not just nice things that people would like to do at some point in their lives. And when they do take this content and make this thing available, when they tap into their specialist expertise and they put it out there and they create that emotional connection, I feel that's the kind of experience that also drives empathy, but it's data driven and I feel it covers kind of all the bases, and it also gives you a very good reference point. And example like these, and the fact that you talk about them is so important just for other people to know that this is possible. Yes, it requires some trial and error, but it is possible. And most often than not, it comes with surprising results and compound effects over time. And I've seen that with content so many times. But how do you, especially in this context and whatever's coming next, how do you get people, how do you persuade them to have a bit more patience? Because we generally, as a race, lack patience, and now it's becoming even more, I don't know, it feels like it's constricting. It's just in shorter supply. So how do you help your customers and other SEOs cultivate this ability to be patient and to work for that compound effect?
Yeah, I think that's very, very difficult. And I, to be completely candid, I don't think I'm particularly excellent with patience at all. I'm very kind of motivated by execution and getting things done quickly. And when I feel patience lacking in a client, it's similarly frustrating for me. So I have complete empathy for any of those that might struggle with this. I do think there is power in patience, though, and I think it's necessary, especially for something like search, where it does typically take anywhere from, you know, 1 to 3 months to get things up and running for improvements. And I think explaining that early on to clients helps set expectations. And that's really preventative to not get you in the hot seat because they're not seeing results within the first week or two. But it's tough. It's really tough. Do you have any prescriptive advice for patients?
I must say I am not the most patient person either. I do believe very much in, my field of action is content marketing. So that also requires patience. It always does, especially if you want to keep it at a certain level and infuse empathy into it and so on. So it's when in those cases where I've managed to develop a long-term strategy and follow through on it, it was based on a relationship of trust with my manager or the CEO or my clients. So I feel like trust is it's fundamental for everything that we do in general, but especially for these kind of experiments and projects where there's a certain dose of uncertainty, and that's very high nowadays. And the only way to bridge this uncertainty is to trust the process and to apply it, and obviously to measure and to see how else that particular effort is serving other parts of the company or the community, and also learn to see those kind of benefits that may be more nuanced and abstract and not something that businesses have customarily measured in the past.
Totally. And good content takes time, right?
Yes.
A quality piece of content to stand the test of time, it's not going to happen overnight.
Exactly. And I feel everything is becoming very personal. I feel we're generally in the creative industries overall, I feel there's this not necessarily a tipping point, but we're at a place where technology mixes a lot with individual experience, and there's this craftsmanship aspect to it, but also the desire to scale that ability to craft a certain kind of campaign and message and content. So I feel we're very lucky to be at this point, and I do believe that marketers can do a lot of good. So I love that we're talking about empathy and SEO, because when people think about this particular sector, empathy may not be at the top of their mind or even just generally not connected to it. But the fact of the matter is that all good specialists work this into their into their body of work generally.
Completely. It's about cultivating that connection with other people and with the audience. And I think that only really comes from, a genuine empathetic place. And I think it's kind of funny. I was just thinking, empathy wasn't always cool or trendy. I've brought this up for years, how this is a huge part of my work and how my focus is always on the audience, and I've always said from day one, when I get on a stage, it is 120% never about me. Never. Not even if they ask me to do a quick intro or a story about myself. I'm constantly wheeling in my head about in what ways can I communicate things to provide value. You know what I mean? It's 100% about the people sitting in those seats giving me their two most valuable resources, their time and their attention. And I have so much respect and empathy for that, that I take my work so seriously as a result. And it means the world to me to just try to be the best catalyst I can be for this information to give to them, because they're giving so much to me. And so it's this beautiful, kind of give and take. And I think it's funny because, again, it wasn't perceived as I don't think it was perceived as a powerful trait to have lots of empathy and to lead with empathy. I've gotten the impression over the years, time and time again, whether it be on podcasts or in interviews, that it wasn't powerful. Maybe it was effective, but I got the perception from other professionals that it wasn't as maybe aggressive or, strategic or all this stuff. And what I think is so interesting is all of a sudden with the current landscape and with COVID, it is number one on everyone's mind. I was on Skype going to call you for this, And while I was waiting, I looked and there was an advertisement in the bottom left-hand corner of the Skype screen. And it said, sell with empathy, Salesforce. Like, it is the most trendy thing right now because all of a sudden it makes sense to people. And I think no one kind of articulated this better than Rand Fishkin's recent post, Read the Room. He is so spot on with that article. And it's, you know, you're speaking to, you know, silent audiences or people who won't even get past the first couple of words if you can't read the room and you don't have empathy for the current situation. So I just think it's so fascinating to see how this is so suddenly sort of shifted, because it was even, I won't say who, but I was doing a podcast not even 2.5 months ago where the hosts were sort of like joking about how that was my thing. Empathy was my thing. And now it's like, it's not a joke. Like it's, I think it's like at the root of being human. And it's at the root of connecting with people and also just understanding them and meeting them where they're at. And I think that's more important today than ever.
It is so true. It's become such a business priority. And the fact that we're here discussing this and that we're seeing it all over the place, and obviously yeah. there are going to be people who only kind of display it or try to mimic it and not actually do the real thing, which is often difficult, and it involves emotional labor, which takes resources and time and patience, like we just discussed. But on the other hand, it's an incredible chance for the people who have been in these companies, because I feel that there are these kind of people everywhere who have been pushing for empathy and for actually using it, leaning into it, really leaning into it, and not just putting it on the list of values and just leaving it there, but doing what, for example, Moz has been doing since forever, because, well, Rand, just like we talked, I mean, you have this the set of principles internally that's called TAGFI, and I was curious how it enhanced your perception and practice of empathy when you joined Moz, because I feel like with your bringing in that particular culture, internal culture, that is a beautiful fit.
It is so beautiful, and I think, you know, it really supported the kind of empathy I had already been leading with and helped it to grow even more. And it made like a safe space for it to be, bring your authentic self to work and to provide content and material and educational resources that, you know, I felt was most empathetic to the user. Yeah.
That is lovely to hear. And it really, I mean, it translates into the community and the fact that, I mean, just you and other colleagues from Moz, like we're seeing, like it was for me, for example, following Kevin from Buffer. It's these kind of messages. And again, Moz and Buffer were talking about empathy since, I mean, we're talking about many, many years before it was cool or trending or even valued. I feel like it was just opening the way and leading the way for those people who felt the same but couldn't really use this part of themselves at work or not use it sufficiently or have a big enough impact. But now that's happening, so that is wonderful to see, I have to say. I wanted to ask, I mean, I feel like there are some aspects of SEO which are a bit more tactical that actually help marketers and even business owners or journalists or developers actually work empathy into everything that they do. And I think about things like accessibility and giving people options to consume content in different lengths and formats. What else could marketers and everyone else who relies on SEO for growth focus on in terms of these small tactical aspects?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I just want to commend you because you are like a rare diamond in the rough who has content marketing knowledge and also completely understands like these other sophisticated aspects of SEO. I had been looking for you for 6 years at my previous agency, and you, there are so few of you. It is insane. I think it's incredibly powerful to find content marketers like you who have that, because it's just like a hybrid superpower. So hopefully we can work together in the future. But
thank you so much.
Seriously, I mean it. That is so refreshing to hear. It's like, oh, so good to hear. There are not enough of you. We need to clone you. yeah, I think, I mean, you. I feel like you hit it on the head with accessibility factors, right? And a lot of that today stems from Lighthouse reports for text size, contrast, image alt text, which was originally created for the visually impaired and still is used for readers that help visually impaired individuals consume content on the web. And so while these things might not be so important for ranking or marketing or any of that stuff, it's incredibly important for accessibility. And I guarantee you that Google, you know, acknowledges that, and they want to provide websites that are accessible to people. Absolutely. So it is very, very important. And oh, I love what you said about providing different ways to consume content. This is so important and always has been. And I think it's just now, I feel like a lot of people and websites I see are sort of waking up to it, is this whole notion of, you know, again, you have to meet the audience where they're at. And so oftentimes, like for Whiteboard Friday, I gave this huge push. And people listening may have noticed this. Last year and the year before, we had just the audio version of the Whiteboard Friday, because I kept pushing for it. I was like, you know, you don't know where these people are, to whether it be on the bus and maybe they don't want to read the whole thing, or they don't want to use up the Wi-Fi, you know, or their data on watching a video. I was like, we got to provide different options to easily consume it. And we have the audio within the video. Why not just apply it here? And, you know, and so exactly like what you said, you know, you don't know whether someone's walking to work. You don't know whether someone wants to consume it this way or that way. And so giving them options is incredibly powerful for retaining a larger percentage of the audience on your site. And I think it's a beautiful way to look at content, and it's also a beautiful way to repurpose things. So yeah, I think that cannot be stressed enough. And similarly to providing different options for consuming, you should absolutely be repurposing top performing content. And I always say top performing content, because why not start with what's currently working for your website? And so oftentimes, you know what ranks well, right? You know what pages convert the most people to whatever it is you're trying to do. And there's no reason why you can't take those pages and create visual elements to a SlideShare, or like I said, a YouTube video, or maybe Pinterest board, or explore these other platforms and have fun with them, and then evaluate what worked and what didn't. I know this was something I did back in probably 2012, 2013 for a stem cell replacement therapy doctor. And so these are adult stem cells that you can get from your own body. But it's very medically technical and intimidating content. And so my team and I thought, you know, why don't we just turn this into really beautiful, easy to consume slideshow, like on a SlideShare. And so we upload it to SlideShare, and we kept doing that. And then we turned it into YouTube videos and all sorts of stuff. But when we came back to the drawing board, we saw, oh my gosh, you know, we were getting such a large percentage of traffic from SlideShare specifically. And it was ranking so well for things that their website couldn't rank for. And so it was expanding the acquisition funnel for this client in ways we never saw before. And it was doing it in the most beautiful of ways, because the traffic they were getting from SlideShare were highly qualified. They stayed on the site the longest. They converted the highest. So I think, you know, constantly reevaluating and pivoting based on what's working well and what's not.
It makes such a difference. Plus, you get to see how people use your content in different contexts. And I love that. And I love advocating for font size and for contrast. And I'm always telling people, just imagine you're walking down the street and you've had a long day and your eyes are strained. You do not want to look at this. This is not going to work. And it's sometimes you have to get subjective to get people's attention, just to put them in the user's shoes for a bit so they can experience that sort of frustration or annoyance that we get. And then people get it.
Yes, that is such a great example. It's also so important why you have to make your content scannable. You absolutely have to. It should be available to people on the run or just wanting to get the quick takeaways. And one of my favorite examples of this, and funny enough, the founder of this does not like me particularly, which, you know, to each their own. He told me I can't write. But that's for a whole nother story. But I think Copyblogger. Mm. So blogger.com I've always said this, they do a beautiful job of providing content where you can literally just kind of skim the article and you get all of the key takeaways and you really feel like you understood what it was you're trying to get across. And I think that is the most powerful, it's another sort of take on accessibility for people that are in a hurry. I mean, our attention span continues to decline. People continue to consume content on their mobile phones and in different use cases, right? So I think considering those things as well. And I'm curious to get your take. Is there any other accessibility factors that you're particularly aware of and advocating for these days?
I really try to make UX as simple as possible. And in terms of content especially, I try to weave everything in really well together. And that includes, of course, internal linking. But it's not only that. It's trying to just mix and match everything that the user would need on a page, or be very clear about what resources they could go deeper into if they want to expand their understanding or knowledge of one topic. And that means connecting the blog to the website much better. It means embedding videos and audio and so much of this, and not leaving them fragmented and stranded somewhere, hoping that someone at some point comes across them naturally, because it doesn't. And I love when I get the whole package. I want to be able to deliver that as well for my readers, hopefully.
That is so beautifully said. Oh my gosh. Can I hire you? That is what I'm talking about. It's thinking of the user. It's user first marketing. And I absolutely love what you said with follow-up resources and, you know, looking at a particular piece of content and thinking, what are the logical next steps? What is the, you know, particular call to action? What makes sense for the user in that moment?
Yes. Well, I learned so much from you, and I learned so much from Rand and from Moz. So I'm very thankful for that, because it became part of how I'm able to do work today. So you played a big role in my development. So thank you for that.
My work here is done, people.
But not before. I wanted to ask if we run overtime, like by 5 or 10 minutes.
We're fine.
Yes. Okay, cool. Because I wanted to ask, we talked a lot about everything that goes into SEO, and there's so much of it, and everything's dependent on, all the elements depend on each other. And not only I feel like this is a metaphor for how the world works. And sometimes we see it in our jobs, but we don't see it at a global scale. And now we see it everywhere. I mean, this interdependence is vital to us. So obviously SEO success depends on collaboration with developers and content creators and a bunch of other roles and companies. How do you go about building that trust in a remote context where people work from around the world? Because I feel like it's a bit more challenging now to go and advocate for a certain project, for a certain take on things or experiments. So how do you do that? Where do you start building that trust and getting people excited about what they can achieve together?
Yeah, that's such, I'm so glad you asked that because I feel like it's a really important part of just being effective, right? So, and it's 10 times more difficult when you're doing it remotely. It's definitely a lot easier to walk into situations or be able to have face-to-face conversations where you can more easily read and understand people. I think oftentimes the remote aspect is, you know, the initial part of that is like what you said earlier is building that trust. And I find that that comes with just being bringing your authentic self to work, bringing your authentic self into meetings and not trying to, you know, kind of dance around something or say that you can do something that, you know, you're not totally comfortable with or whatever that might be. And oftentimes I know, at least so for me, it's admitting what I don't know and saying, you know, limitations of different particular parts of my research and just being real upfront and honest about them with that. And I think that cultivates a sense of trust that I'm not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. You know, I want to be on the same page. I want us to make these decisions together. And I think that, you know, that really starts from building that foundational trust and rapport with individuals. And also just really better understanding their roles, whoever your point person is, and how you can continue to deliver surprise and value to them goes extremely far. And also, I know with working with developers, it's really about communicating how implementing, whether it be SEO improvements or something like schema markup, is going to improve the perceived quality of their work, right? And that it will be more effective. And a lot of times too, with the more technical SEO stuff, I actually love working with developers on that because that's a beautiful opportunity for collaboration. Where if I go to a developer on a website and I say, hey, you know, I found these 5,000 pages that are really low, thin quality pages. I would like them to be de-indexed. And what I mean by that is implementing these meta robots tags. But, you know, I don't know the best way to do that. You know the website far better than I do. And maybe you have a better idea for how to most effectively implement something like this. And then it becomes collaboration. And I think that's where the best work is done. And not only does collaboration make an SEO and a website way more efficient, but you also get to share the wins, which I don't think we do enough. Like when, you know, when things start to improve, it's so fun to be able to email the developers and the, you know, in-house marketers and people and just be like, you guys are killing it. Like, look at this. This looks so good. You're getting this. And I think that's also an important part of kind of building that team and building that momentum for future work.
It so is. And I feel like we should all be kind of reminding each other of these wins because we need them. We need them to build energy. We need them to be just connected to the results of our work. And sometimes there's such a long way. And there are so many projects happening at once that you get disconnected from that end result. And just sharing a print screen of someone's feedback or a comment or things like that, they go such a long way. So I'm really, really glad you're setting this tremendous example for for how to work with people, because that's such a big thing right now. It's going to become even more important as we have these all virtual interactions that we need to learn how to navigate and still be ourselves in the process.
Totally. Yeah, I could not agree with that more. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. If you wanted to add something, didn't want to interrupt.
Well, I was just thinking, and you can include this if you think it's a good fit or not, but looping back to what I had just briefly and weirdly touched on earlier with the Brian Clark copy blogger story, I think having an understanding of empathy and having perspective of being aware when something happens or something comes at you and having the know-it-all to understand when it's not you, you know what I mean? And so I think for that particular situation, which was very public and a lot of people are aware of you know, kind of what went down. It's funny. I love Brian Clark. I think he does amazing work. To this day, I like constantly joke about like sending him flowers or something, because I feel like his incredibly harsh criticism really lit a fire under me, and also kind of taught me. Probably 3 years ago now, 3.5 years ago or so, and it really was sort of an interesting perspective to understand that, you know, you can handle so much more than you think you can. And having the empathy and the understanding of why these things come about, because a person is just deeply uncomfortable with something that is currently happening. And they take, I mean, we all do this, right? We're the harshest on the people we love the most and the people we're closest with, because we can't wrestle with things that we're dealing with sometimes, and we take it out on people. And I'm not speaking for him or saying that's exactly what happened, but I think having empathy for whatever that might have been for the other individual, in like this case, it was someone I deeply, deeply admired, and particularly admired his work and his writing and his team and all this stuff. And to hear a particular hero of yours that you admire for writing tell you that you are a shit writer is incredibly hard to swallow and wrestle with. And oftentimes things like that can be debilitating, right? We get paralyzed by this fear of not meeting other people's expectations. And especially when it comes from someone you so deeply admire, it, for whatever reason, it cuts so much deeper. And I think I tell this story just because you're going to encounter stuff like that. You're going to encounter people saying deeply horrible things to you if you're putting yourself out there online, if you're trying to create content, if you're, you know, trying to move to the next level. It's not without these things that, you know, these obstacles. And I think in one essence, it means you're on the right track. Right? Like Ryan Holiday's book that I absolutely love, The Obstacle is the Way. And I could not agree more. And I actually had a friend during that whole time when this was happening, and he goes, you know what? This is the best thing that's ever going to happen to you. We just turned it, you know, we turned it. And I was like, I'm going to prove it wrong. And it's okay. Like, you know, people that love me and know me, you know, have this, you know, I don't have to worry about this stuff so much. But I think you're going to encounter obstacles. You're going to encounter critiques from people you work with, or edits, or pushback, or failure, or, you know, just even mistakes here and there. And I think that should not deter you from staying on path and continuing to try to create positive change. Because I think, again, it means you're on the right path, and you have to embrace that. And especially in this situation, in this environment, it's something that none of us can change. It's deeply painful to deal with the day-to-day, you know, statistics and all of those things. But if we can just really kind of surrender to it and welcome sort of the discomfort and roll with it, you're going to be so much more effective, and your mental health and your internal life is going to be so much better off because of it too.
I so deeply love everything you said right now. It spoke to me so much. I had a similar experience at some point with someone I really admire who told me that a certain job, it always seemed like it was too much for you. And I carried that with me for such a long time. But it actually helped me realize, I mean, just sitting with that, because there's nowhere to go, helped me realize that I needed a different way to work, because I was trying to fit someone else's pattern that didn't really fit my needs. And changing that simply accelerated everything towards a more positive place where I can be myself. And so I love that you're sharing this. I know it's so deeply personal. That it's difficult to talk about this. And I hope you keep telling the story, simply because it's proof of self-empathy and the fact that we can take from these harsh critiques, or whatever they may be, whatever form they may take, and figure out what I love doing yoga with Adrienne, which is like super big on YouTube. And she has this thing where she says, take what you need, leave what you don't. And I feel like that's such a good just general rule for getting feedback? Because if you know how to get feedback, then you're going to get better at giving feedback.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. And I think those of us that are very serious about our professional and personal growth crave that feedback. I know I do. Like, I want to be better. I genuinely, like, especially after talks or a particular piece of content, if you can email me how I could improve, I will have so much respect for you. So I think, yeah, that kind of comes with the territory as well. But oh, that is so beautiful. I love how you said that.
I feel so, like this conversation could go into many, many directions, and I would absolutely love to hopefully maybe do this again sometimes, because I feel like there's so much more to dig into from your experience.
There's so much more. I know. I'm already like thinking of all these other things. It is so amazing.
That's good, because something that I particularly loved about doing this entire season that's focused on empathy and talking to you and talking to everyone else who's part of this season is the fact that it became such a powerful source of energy, because it triggered those super powerful and positive emotions inside of us. And that kind of overflows towards everyone who's listening. And it overflows into, for me, it had an effect that lasted for weeks and weeks. So, and it gets reactivated each time I listen to it. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, what do you think makes empathy timeless for us generally as humans, and maybe for your work as well?
Oh, I love that question. I think what makes empathy timeless really revolves around the connectivity of it. And how that's never going away. You know, we are going to continue to need to connect with other people for all sorts of reasons. And the more effectively you can do that, the more powerful you become. And one like quick last story is, I've just been thinking about this so much. And before the lockdown occurred, I was in Colorado staying with a really good friend of mine, Paul Dowell, and he owns this really incredible e-commerce clothing brand called Tall T Productions. And if you've ever watched X Games or the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, you've seen his clothes. And he just does incredible stuff. He's widely known in the snowboard industry. And we were chatting about all of this that's going on and how disruptive and strange, and how do you market in a time like this? How do you navigate? What does this look like? And he has such a close relationship with his customers, which is unbelievable, because I mean, they're all over the world. And he was, you know, playing around with this idea of sending this mass text message to all of his customers. And he was playing around with a couple different ways he could maybe, you know, offer a tiny bit of something or do something. And he finally was just like, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. Right. Like, it just feels awful. And so he ended up sending a message out that was something like, no, this is really strange time for everyone. Just know that like myself and the entire company are really thinking of all of you. And we hope that you're keeping your chins up. And it was just like, so Paul, and so sweet and genuine, and coming from the most beautiful place of him sincerely caring and thinking about his customers and offering, you know, doing nothing more, no selling, no nothing. And it was literally just that connection. And he received over something like 600 replies from individual customers where they can text back. He sat down that within that day and made a custom reply to every single one of those 600 people. I mean, it just blew my mind. And he has no idea how good of a natural marketer he even is, because this is just the world. And I'm like, oh my God, I travel the world. I speak on stages with the best, you know, e-commerce or marketers. I'm like, Paul, this is marketing. This is like, you know, Will Reynolds, real company shit. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable that he... And some of them were not short. Do you know what I mean? And they know that this is coming from the CEO, the founder of this huge company. And I think about it all the time. And I've been telling this story all the time because it goes back to like that connecting and to what you said earlier about how essential it is to deeply understand your customers and what they want and just connecting with them on a deeper level that is beyond the brand, beyond the message, beyond anything, that's just at a very human level. And, you know, with what Paul did, he did see a spike in sales. That is not what he wants. You know, he wasn't going after that. And he sincerely spent an entire day, you know, his fingers were about to fall off, but it was the most beautiful example that I have seen of marketing in a time like this. And it was done so naturally, you know, and I think that's what, you know, Rand alludes to that too, in his writing about reading the room and dealing with this crisis, is really come to it with the help first mentality. You know, what is it within your means that you can provide right now? You know, don't even think about selling or, you know, any of those aspects. Lead with that, you know, help first mentality. And I think that is what's going to take people so far throughout this whole climate and the next several months.
It absolutely is. And you rounded up this entire conversation perfectly. This example is absolutely fantastic. And sometimes it's absolutely amazing. And sometimes all we need is that feeling of connection with others, feeling less alone, feeling seen, feeling recognized and acknowledged. And that makes all the difference. And it's also the basis of these powerful relationships that we need to move things forward, whatever may happen. I think it's the only reliable thing that we have, to know that we can trust and depend on each other. So thank you for giving us all your beautiful personal perspectives and your experience. I feel like I do see SEO in a way through your eyes that I've never seen it before through anyone else. And I love that you're bringing this to the community and that you brought this to this show as well. So thank you so much, Brittany.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Best questions ever.
Thanks for exploring empathy and its many nuances with us. If you found it helpful, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and leave a review. Until next time, this is Andra Zaharia, and thank you for listening to the Drag and Drop Show from Banner Snacks.